Your seats, we would like to begin. First of all, on behalf of Religious Zionists of Chicago Mizrahi and the other co-sponsoring organizations, the Yeshiva University, Torah Mitzion Kollel, B'nai Akiva, and Camp Mosheva, I want to welcome everyone here to the Yom Iyun held in tribute to the memory of Yaakov Levi Matenki, Zichrono Livracha. Not going to spend any time you didn't come to hear me, but I would just like to again welcome you. Mizrahi is undergoing a tremendous revitalization. We invite you all to participate, to become members. There's some membership forms in the back by the table, by the refreshments. Please join us, become part of the team, and we have done wonderful things in the last couple of years. We expect to do even greater things. Without any further ado, I will turn it over to Rabbi Matenki.
Thank you, Rabbi Eisenberg, and thank you to the Mizrahi, Mosheva, Bnei Akiva, the Kollel, for continuing to give us the opportunity to sponsor this Yom Iyun in memory of Yaakov. Last night, when I was trying to decide what I would say as a few words of introduction, I realized that this is the first time in the 14 years that we have been part of this Yom Iyun that the Yom Iyun falls on the week of what was Yaakov's Bar Mitzvah Parsha, Parshat Nitzavim. And so I figured that it would be very appropriate to go back in my notes and see what Divrei Torah had offered 21 years ago when he was Bar Mitzvah. And I opened up the file and I realized that when I started reading it, that the opening words were that I was not going to give a Dvar Torah at his Bar Mitzvah. So that Dvar Torah was set aside for a moment. Instead, on that Shabbos, the one thing I did say is I referred to the opening words of this week's parsha of Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem Lifnei Hashem Elokechem, that you are standing today before God, and then the way the parsha continues by listing all of the groups of Klal Yisrael. And I offered him the bracha that he should continue to be part of the greater Klal Yisrael, to be part of that Mesorah, part of the tradition of being involved in the Jewish community, being involved with family, and being involved with his own personal growth as a Ben Torah. In his short life, in the 8 years that followed, Yaakov fulfilled all of those dreams and all of those wishes, and it is with a great sense of honor and privilege that we recognize the Mizrahi established this Yom Iyun in his memory, because it really brings together all of those themes as well. We are honored this morning to have three speakers. The first will be our Rosh Beis Din, Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, who I will introduce in just a moment. The second, Rabbi Brand, who I'll have the privilege of introducing as well. And the third will be Rabbi Yalkut, now of Pittsburgh. The reason all three are part of this program is really very, very simple. I can't imagine a Torah program taking place in Chicago without Rabbi Schwartz's participation. And Rabbi Brand, in his time here in Chicago, has helped truly transform our Torah learning. And so again, Rabbi Brand is an obvious connection as well. And Rabbi Yalkut was a friend of Yaakov's. And so when I asked my children this year, who should we bring in? They said, why don't you bring in Rabbi Yalkut? And so this way we have the Torah leadership of our community, and we also have that piece that connects everything else with the friendships and also the continuing involvement in community through Rabbi Yalkut. I have taken more than enough time. It is always a great honor and a great privilege to have Rabbi Schwartz with us, not only in our community, but also in events such as this. Without any further ado, it is my honor to introduce Harav HaGaon Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz Shlita.
Thank you, Rabbi Matenki. And of course, I'm very sensitive and feeling at this Yom HaZikaron, in view of represents a loss, but at the same time, been able to build it into something which is of great meaning, especially to his life and to the life of our general community. And we're talking about the different speakers. The name of the last speaker is Yalkut, which generally means a gathering together of different things. There's a Yalkut Shemoni, there's a Yalkut Ruveni. So Yalkut, you have a gathering of three types of speakers here this morning. So that fits into the mood of exactly what you were saying as a variegated type of presentation. So Meir Habesai, also it's a little bit, I find it a little bit challenging this morning. It's after Slichas, which took place not too long ago, not long ago this morning. So people say, how are you going to do it? So I says, I learned to sleep with my eyes open. Anyhow, getting to this subject, and I selected this subject not just out of, picked it, in other words, just grabbed the subject and begin to speak about it. It relates to the aspect of religious Zionism and so forth, because the basis of religious Zionism ultimately is Aliyah, to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And when we talk about the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the question always is, are you allowed to live in another country? If there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, if you're not living in Eretz Yisrael, is that a active beetle, a nullification of that mitzvah? And there's discussion about it. According to the Ramban, it would be, because he said, he, in the Chumash and in the mitzvah sasei of his Hasogas, his criticism of the Rambam and the Sefer HaMitzvahs, was the Rambam does not mention that there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael in all of his works. He doesn't say it's a separate mitzvah, which is a discussion in the Paskim I'm not going into. So now I picked a subject that has to do with something that we find in the Torah, and two parallel ideas, some of which remained a constant rumor through the centuries, and another which became part of a contemporary discussion by Rabbanim and others about living in another country. So the first is about living in Egypt, in Mitzrayim, where we'll quote in a moment the sources of what the Torah prohibits, living in Mitzrayim or returning to Mitzrayim, and also about Spain after the awesome Gerus Sfarad in 1492, which is so significant, is such a hashgacha from the divine providence on the day on Tisha B'Av, when Columbus set sail. That was the day historically for what he called the India, the passage to India and so forth, and discovered the New World. That was the day when Jews had to leave Spain by the edict of Ferdinand and Isabella, the rulers, the monarchy of Castile and Aragon, which persecuted the Jews the whole time. So anyhow, that's so significant. And of course, later on, the awesome Holocaust and so forth, the question arose, how can you ever go back to Germany or visit Germany or walk on the soil of that country which did such horrible things to our people? And whatever is mentioned there, so I found sources above and beyond the most evident sources about returning to Egypt, which are there in the Torah. And without going into explanation within the confines of time this morning, first let's look at what the prohibitions having to do with Egypt. And the best way I felt was to cite from the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, that in Perek Hei of Hilchos Malachim, the Rambam really has a summation in his inimitable way of describing the prohibitions and the Surim of the edicts of not to return or live in Egypt. So the Rambam first makes a great statement which actually reinforces the idea that the Rambam seems to say there is no special mitzvah saseh to live in Eretz Yisrael. as far as the mitzvah saseh is concerned. The Rambam just says here, the language, umutar lishkam b'chol ha'olam chutz me'aretz Mitzrayim. It's permissible to live in any part of the world except for the land of Egypt. That's the way he starts out making that summation. So first of all, he's not talking about a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Of course, those that want to explain the Rambam that's not against the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, they explain it since the Rambam goes in other places of his code and throughout the confines of rabbinic literature to describe all the mitzvahs atluyas bi'oritz, all the mitzvahs that are dependent upon living in Eretz Yisrael, it's a concept. It must be something. Eretz Yisrael must be very important if he has every detail from Bavli and Roshalmi and other areas of Torah literature of how to perform all the mitzvahs of a Jew living in Eretz Yisrael. In fact, Rav Kook Zal once explained, just like the Baal Halachas Gedolos, that Rav Yehudoi Gaon wrote a sefer on mitzvos, which of course was many centuries before the Rambam, doesn't mention there's a mitzvah to believe in God. Sounds strange, as a mitzvah. So they explain, how come? They said, because if you perform all the other mitzvahs, every mitzvah you perform is a belief in Hashem. It's a command that comes from Hashem. So the same way, if you observe the mitzvah Satluyas Be'oretz, you're believing that this is the place where you can have fulfillment of many mitzvahs. So Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is very important there, although it's not a separate mitzvah. So I don't want to go extensively into that. There's much discussion. So when the Rambam says you can't live in any other place, you can live rather every place except the Eretz Mitzrayim. And he describes the boundaries of Eretz Mitzrayim as he knew it. Mi'ayam HaGadol, he's referring to the area of the Mediterranean that covers, you know, the northern part of Egypt from the distance, how far is what is considered the land of Mitzrayim. And that's a debate. In fact, there's a debate in Rishonim between Rashi and Reb Sadia Gaon that the Vadi El Arish, you know, in the Six-Day War, everybody heard about El Arish, which was a type of stream that only came alive after tremendous rains. Otherwise, it was a wadi. It was a dried-out riverbed and so forth. Whether that's the boundary of Eretz Mitzrayim or whether that's the boundary of Eretz Yisrael. Some say it should be to the mouth of the Nile. Eretz Yisrael should stretch all the way to the delta of the Nile, whatever it is. So the Rambam describes, he says there's a prohibition, he's saying, and the vow, his language is, and states it quite clearly, he mentions the psukim there about Egypt, and he says the following, when he describes the geography of it, you're not supposed to really dwell there, live there. Bishleisha Mekaimus, the three places in the Torah, mentions the prohibition of returning or living in Eretz Mitzrayim. Now, the three places, without going through all the details, in one, there's mention of the first place that is stated that Lo Seisif L'Yoreso, you can't go back to go and see El. In fact, we read it yesterday in Parshas Kisovo, that you can't go back, to see the land of Mitzrayim. At the end of the Teichacha, it's talking about that. And also you have in Parshas Bishalach, you have it, and also you have it in another Parsha, where he mentions in here that the Teirah, it describes the Isa, Shlosha Mekamus, Hezira Teira Shalo Losho Lemitzrayim, No Sasifa Loshu Bader Chazeh Od. You can't go back here, that's from Parshas Kisavo. Lo Sasif Lereso, Lo Sasifa Lereso Od Ad Olam. That's what you have. You can't go back and see it. So the question is, so they all ask the Kasha. You're not supposed to live, but of course the Rambam does say, that according to Mikayos and the Yerushalmi is that there, however, when it comes to, you can go back there for schera, for business purposes. You have to do business, schera, pragmatia, whatever it is, you can go enter the land of Egypt and whatever it is. But a question of dwelling there permanently, that's considered an Issa. So all the Meforshim and the Rambam are making it very quickly within the confines of time. They all ask a kasha on the Jewish communities that lived in Egypt in the Middle Ages. The Rambam himself lived in Fostat, which is a suburb of Cairo. And he describes even his daily in the Igos HaRambam, which is a fascinating thing, the letters of the Rambam, if you read them in translation or even in the original Hebrew, which are available, he describes his day, that in the morning he went to the Sultan's palace, Sultan Saladin, at the time was the leader of the Arab world against the Crusaders, who already conquered the land, conquered what we call Israel, Palestine, whatever they referred to in those times. He was his personal physician and the entire royal court of that sultan. And then he comes back after spending a whole day. He writes, he's exhausted. He finds a room full of patients of awaiting to see him. He was a great physician. And after he did that, then he sat down to learn. And you can imagine all the things that the Rambam wrote, his inexhaustible ability, intellectual power to write and to discuss, to learn in all of the Talmudic literature. So they all ask, how come the Rambam lived there? So the answer they want to give is that he didn't have much choice because he could not live but amongst the Crusaders, Christians who massacred Jews. I mentioned a few times to people, and the first thing that the first crusade was successful in conquering Israel, what we call Israel today, one of the first things they did in Yerushalayim, they gathered up all the Jews, put them in a shul, and they burned it down with the Jews inside. That was their first thing that they did. Under Gottfried de Bouillon, there are a lot of stories about him. He was the French leader of the first crusades. There's stories about him in Rashi. So that was not a place for a person like the Rambam to live. So he ended up in Mitzrayim, originally born in Spain. He had to flee from radical elements of Muslims who came into Spain there in Cordova. No, he went to North Africa, and that's how he ends up in Mitzrayim. So they ask, how come he lived there? So the answer is quite obvious. He had no particular choice. So, and some want to explain that the whole Isser of return to Mitzrayim is going from El Chishoyal to Mitzrayim. But if you come from another country to live in Egypt, some want to say that's the answer, that's how you were allowed. Whatever the reason is, there were communities in Mitzrayim within the concept of whether they went there for business or schar, or let's say they started out with business and later on they remained there settling. So some want to say that. And since Lechatchila ab initio, they did not go there to settle. Originally went to do business transactions, then later they were there. They're not transgressing the Issa. So that's a matter of Talmudic and rabbinic discussion. So that's where we have this prohibition of the land of Egypt. So the Torah does say that there is an Issa. Someone to ask Lechatchila today, are you allowed to go and settle in Egypt? I would tell them no. The Rambam says that you shouldn't do that, Lechatchila. First place today, it's not a good place for Jews to be in general, there in Cairo or Egypt or so forth. That's a very practical consideration. Now let's go to something else which is part of our subject. What about Spain? Now, I found a very interesting tshuva. It's in a sefer. There's a sefer on Masechet Rosh Hashanah, which is, of course, part of the subject matter of this time of the year. There's a sefer called Truas Melech. This sefer, Truas Melech, was published in the 1930s. Who is the author of this sefer? Was a great rabbinic luminary from Lita. His name was Reb Yosef Zismanovich Zal. Reb Yosef Zitzmanovich was the Rav of the Lithuanian city of Vilkomir, but he was known as the son-in-law of the Gaon Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein Zal, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka, Knesset Yisrael, who took that yeshiva in the 1920s to Eretz Yisrael, Hebron. He established it in Hebron. Of course, anybody knows the tragic history that in 1929 there was this terrible massacre of the yeshiva people in Hebron, and the yeshiva moved to Yerushalayim. So Hebron yeshiva is really Slobodka yeshiva, Knesset Yisrael, the Musa yeshiva that was originally founded in the after the name of Reb Yisrael Salant. So Reb Yosef Zismanovich, who had, they have a nickname for him, they called him their Yerushalmi, because he was a book, he was a great Gaon. In fact, his an intellectual capacity as a rabbinic mind parallels the same type of methodology that you would have from Reb Chaim Soloveitchik Zal, the Brisker method and so forth. So in his Sefer on Rosh Hashanah, and this is only tangential, because he's writing on subjects having to do with Rosh Hashanah, it's on the Masechta, on that tractate of Talmud. So in there he has a tshuva of all places. He has a tshuva written, and this is what's most significant. This tshuva was written to another famous rabbinic luminary who survived the Holocaust. Reb Yosef Zismanovich was murdered by the Germans later on when they came to Lithuania, when they invaded Russia, with all the Jews of most of Lithuanian Jewry and good part of Russian Jewry. I don't have to elaborate on the point. So he writes this. This is Tough Reish Tzadik Gimel. In fact, you don't know the date until the end, and it gives you a big shock. He's writing to the Gaon Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg Zal. Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was originally the Rosh Yeshiva of the Beis Medrash L'Rabbonim, the Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin. But he himself was a Litvish Gaon. He came out of Slobodka. He was a Slobodka brilliant mind and took over after the Rav Reb David Zvi Hoffman passed away. So this tshuva is written to Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg and the Kol HaRabbonim to Berlin, 1933. What happened in 1933? Hitler, Yamach Shemo, came to power as the Chancellor of Germany. And the rest, you know, the tragic, awesome history, what happened. But this is written, doesn't mention anything about that. But when you read about it, you can understand why it was written. So the question was asked to him, is there a cherem, is there an excommunication edict to live in Spain, Spania, that's the way, he doesn't use the word Sfarad, in Spain. So if there was a cherem, because there seemed to be a accepted fact that it was prohibited for Jews to go back to Spain, who had been driven out in 1492, as I mentioned earlier. Was it prohibited, a cherem to set foot? And there seemed to be some sort of a rumor or whatever it was, not to go back. So he was asked about that. In fact, he was asked in a practical way, whether you can go back today, in that time, to Spain. You know how significant that means when looming on the horizon of Jews running away from Germany, where could they go? Who would let them in? Where could they live? Where could they settle? That's in the back of your mind once you see when it was written. So he answers it on two levels. He said, if it was just a cherem, what you call a cherem, any bezdin, any rabbinic court that is legitimate could cancel the cherem. So if it was only a cherem, you gather together a bezdin, and you're mavatal the cherem others. It has nothing to do with being a bigger bezdin or a lesser bezdin. However, if it was a takana, there's a difference between a cherem, which is just an excommunication edict, and another bezdin can nullify it, just like someone makes a neder. You learn in the Daf Yomi, the Nedorim, Nazirus, vows, and so forth, Erev Rosh Hashanah, where we besides the Kol Nidra and Yom Kippur, everybody has HaTorah LaDorim, Erev Rosh Hashanah. You call together a Bezdin and you mevatel all the Dorim and everything else, you cancel them out. So if that's the case, it's easy. If it was only a Chayim. However, and this is where he makes a distinction, if it was what we call a Takona, and he brings proof, there's a famous Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershon. The Chayim Rabbeinu Gershon, who was the great rabbinic luminary in France, and also they called him the Mor HaGola, the light of the exile, at a rabbinic convocation, banned polygamy amongst the Jewish people. It's prohibited. Up to that time, it was not prohibited. But why that's done, that's a different subject. But he banned it. So it was a Chayim. However, if it was a Chayim, all you had to do, you want to abolish it, get another Bezin, and cancel it. But later on, Rabbeinu Tam, and that's found in the Tshuvas of Baram Mirutenberg, who was one of the Gdeli Rishonim, who was the Rebbe of the Rosh, Rabbeinu Osher, who originally was in Germany and came to Toledo in Spain. So he says, if it's a Takana, now you can't be Mavatal a Takana. The klal is, Ein Bezin Yohel Levatal Dibi B'chaveir, Bezin Chaveil, Ein Only Im Kain Golem Imenu B'chokhmo V'minyan. You have to be a greater Bezdin. It's not just the amount of people that you have to have the prestige of those G'dalim that are part of the Bezin. Who's greater than the Rabbeinu Tam? You can't be Mavatal that Takona. The only thing, those later Rishonim after Rabbeinu Gershom said, you could cancel out the polygamy, what we call a Heter Meir Rabbonim. That sometimes there's a situation of an Ishus where they will allow the man officially by putting a get in escrow, and 100 Rabbonim will sign that he's allowed to remarry. So officially, he really has two wives, according to Jewish law. So that's the only exception. So that's built into the Takana. But you can't be Mavato the Takana. So if it was a Takana, a great Eduk, not just a Cherem to live in Spain, you won't be able to be Mavato. But what does he conclude in the last paragraph? He says, he hasn't found this in any rabbinic word. And he said, and then he has another point. He says, Spain today is a republic. 1933, it was a republic. It was not a monarchy. You know, in 1936, the awesome Spanish Civil War began. That Civil War was started by those who were monarchist or dictatorial. And that's also a strange quirk in history. Who was the generalissimo of the rebels of Spain that came into Spain with his troops from North Africa, the Moors and others? It was Franco. General Israel Francisco Franco was a ruthless general and conqueror. That's all I want to say. It's a strange quirk of history. This is tangential, because when Jews later fled to Spain, he did not persecute them. He did not do anything. He didn't hand them over to the Germans or so forth, because during the Spanish Civil War, you know what Spain was? It was the practice ground for the German Air Force and the Italian Air Force under Mussolini. Hitler Mussolini practiced their bombing, their planes, the Stukas and the other types of planes that they had. They even sent in their own, there were German troops and officers in Spain, and Italian officers on the side of Franco. So that's a quirk. So however, in 1933, up through the end of the Civil War, it was officially a republic. He says it's a republic that even if there was a Chayim, and even if there was a Takona, but was against a kingdom, and he mentions Isabella, that's the way it was. But if it's under a different rule, perhaps you don't even have to have, you don't have to worry about going back to Spain. So that's written on the eve, on the time when Hitler, Yamach Shemo, was taking over Germany, Chancellor of Germany. It's most significant that you have that. Now, what about Germany itself? Now, who talks about putting a cheirem on Germany? I don't know whether you felt it, anybody that's traveled in Europe after the Holocaust. And I was together with Rabbi Batankis here. You bear witness of the fact we were on several missions from 2003. I think it was about 8 missions that went to Eastern Europe and part of Central Europe. We went to Poland. We went to former Soviet Russia. We went to Lithuania. We went to Belarus. We went to Hungary. We went to Prague. Went to all of these places in Europe, but especially when you came to Poland, or when we landed in Germany, you're traveling on Lufthansa. That's the airline, German. And the language over is Deutsch. You know, they're talking about the German and then in English. You get a strange feeling. Though I never was in Europe, I was born in this country, but those were my first experiences. And we landed in Frankfurt, for example, or if we ended up in Munich, and we davened in the airport, you see all the Germans around, I felt like saying, well, stick it to them, this is it. I felt like, here we are. But it's a strange feeling. So in this tshuvas of the Gaon Reb Meshulam Roth, Reb Meshulam Roth was a great rabbinic decisor who was the Rav of Chernovitz. Chernovitz was a big city, it's a historic city, had great rabbonim in the area of Bukovina. That's a part of Romania, it was then Moldova, part of Russia, whatever it is, came to Eretz Yisrael, and he was immediately appointed as one of the rabbonim of the Supreme Rabbinic Court, of the Bezen Elyon of Eretz Yisrael. So his tshuvas are Kol Mevaser. That's the name of the tshuvas. So in the tshuva there, he said there was a conference of rabbonim, and the question was raised, maybe we ought to make a cheirem against Jews going back to live in Germany after the awesome atrocities. It's indescribable. The more you read about the Holocaust and everything else, it's unbelievable. The massacres, the lack of sensitivity, the murders, I don't have to go into that. So maybe we should make a cheirem, as if to say, don't set foot in Germany. So the matter was brought up. So he said, first, like Spain, he said, they use Spain as an example. So first of all, he goes right to the point. He doesn't know of any rabbinic work that ever mentions a cheirem against Spain. There was no record of it. There's no actual rabbinic processing of a cheirem against Spain. So that's number one. And he says, point number two, if you're going to make a gzeor, an edict, there's a klal in the Talmud, the Gemara, the Veda Zohar, in several places. Ein gezing zeva al atzibur, elim kein atzibur yechaylim lamed bo. You cannot enact an edict again for the community unless the community has the capability of accepting it. You can't put something on Jews and say this is what you have to do unless they can accept it. I mean, we're not talking about a law of the Torah, which we're bound to accept, but to make a gzeira which really is unacceptable, you can't do it. I'll give you one example. He doesn't mention that. For example, they tried to make a gzeira pasakum, eating bread made baked by non-Jews, or so forth. Just like there's a isur bishalakum of cooking by non-Jews, but what about pas bread? They first want to make such a gzeira, so they said that you can't do that. Ein gezing gzeira, elam kein, because people travel, there are places you'll get kosher bread. It's kosher intrinsically, but baked by goyim, and pasas seems to be chai nefesh. It's mentioned that way in the Yerushalmi. So you can't. So to make a gzeira that you can't, as if to say, set foot in Germany, the world Jewry won't be able to accept such a particular type of gzeira. In fact, again, it's a quirk of history. Anyone who's traveled to Eretz Yisrael, who is the greatest trading partner of Israel? Germany. Germany and Poland. All the original anti-Semitic and everything else. But they're the great part. You see all the German products. The buses, the cars, everything is all German made, mostly. Imagine if there was a gzera not to have anything to do with, not to set foot, or so forth. So that's a, he says that's an impossibility, actually, for us to do that. So that's his main point, that you can't make a gzera on something that would be impossible for people to accept. And I would, so therefore, there is no prohibition on living in Spain or going to Spain or into Germany. Not that I encourage it. In fact, I just want to conclude by saying I recently saw a book. It was published several years ago, and it's a collection of essays and statements by Jews living now in Germany. There are over 50,000 Jews that live in Germany, mostly in Berlin and other places. And many of these people are very articulate, intellectuals, professors, or high-quality business people, and they write about their feelings. How do they feel as a Jew living in Germany in the time of the Holocaust? That book is called Speaking Out Loud, and it's edited by someone, Susan Stern, who itself originally was an American, lived and moved to Germany. Many of these people moved to Germany because of the jobs or whatever it was. So it's a very strange type of situation. From an individual standpoint, I've known some people who went through the Holocaust or so forth would never want to set foot in that. And a professor in the yeshiva who fled Vienna, who was 35 years on the faculty at the University of Vienna, was a great classical professor. I would say in his discipline, he was a gaon. Amazing man, Dr. Bernard Flachel of Ashalom. But when he came to America, he broke his teeth speaking English. He would never say a word in German. He didn't like when fellows even spoke Yiddish in front of him because it's Germanic. So he couldn't even mention the names of what happened because of his experience and so forth. So that's a personal item, but to make an edict, that we do not find on the books, and that's where it's left. So ultimately, let us hope and pray that in this world, which many places unsafe for Jews, should be more safe for Jews, but the ultimate safety, as somebody said, the safest place for Christians in the world is Israel. Because in Europe, they're being murdered or attacked by radical Muslims and others and so forth and so on. So the safest place really for the Jewish people is Eretz Yisrael. Let's hope and pray that this year should bring the Geula Shlema, b'mehera b'yomeinu.